afternoon. It's 12:07. You're tuned to Midday Matters right here on WBOI Fort Wayne. I'm Sean Beter. Glad to be with you on this rather dreary but warm Monday afternoon. We're going to be talking today, about the General Assembly doing our regular legislative check-in on this long session. Joining us to help sort things out, Bob Kaler from the Fort Wayne News Sentinel. Bob, how are you today?
Feeling fine. It's a day in spring that feels like spring. Exactly. What's to complain about?
Exactly. We appreciate you being here once again, Bob. With us as well in studio, returning triumphantly, I would say.
Hopefully. We'll find out.
It's Dan Stockman from the Fort Wayne Journal Gazette. Dan, welcome back.
I'm glad to be here.
And with us Leonard Williams, professor of political science at Manchester University. Leonard, we appreciate you being with us as well here.
I'm happy to be here in the studio.
And joining us a little bit later to talk about education issues and education legislation as it moves through the State House this session, Ellie Moxley from our State Impact team covering education will be with us by phone. You'll want to stick around for the second half of the show for that. Gentlemen, I want to start with, the reason that this is the long session. The budget, the state budget is being hammered out. Dan Stockman, let me start with you. We're just starting to get details about the new budget proposal here. There's been a little bit of give in terms of the GOP in the House and Senate and Governor Pence. Can you summarize a little bit of what you've seen from the State House so far?
They're both giving what? Mud and no. Government budgets are complicated enough. But add to it, Indiana creates this extra little wrinkle. We don't just make 1 year budget. We have to make a 2 year budget. So, forecasts are always difficult. It now double all of that. And on top of it, the state budget is so economically dependent. You have these huge swings in revenue with the economy. And so, and on top of that, we have a new governor who wants to make a splash and has his own agenda. And one of the things that he campaigned on and really wants is a tax cut. He wants to lower the state income tax. Well, that political reality is bumping against some of the economic reality. And the economic reality is, there's more revenue to go around, but it's nowhere near what it was 5 years ago, 6 years ago now. And we have all these cuts you've got the legislature trying to patch holes that were kind of ripped into the budget over the last few years. So they're really not anxious to give up revenue at this point.
Bob Kaler, looking at this budget, this legislature does seem like it has a little bit of money to spend. After many years of cuts to education, state education gets about a 3% increase, a total of about $300 million. Is it going to make a difference to local schools, do you think, and folks who have for so long been working to do more with less?
I'm sure it will make a difference. I'm not sure of the magnitude of difference it's going to make. And at the same time that's happening, and they're looking at the budget that will begin this summer. The sequestration cuts. That's one area where they really will have an effect. Is funding for a lot of the enrichment programs or the programs for children that are disadvantaged educationally. So the state will be giving more money. The feds are going to be withdrawing some money from local education. And I don't know how those will balance. Mm-hmm.
And I want to get to the three big highlights in this budget so far have really been the tax cut that the governor has asked for, and then schools and roads. And I want to get to infrastructure in just a moment. But Leonard Williams, Governor Pence campaigned on a 10% tax cut for all Hoosiers. That's been the thing he's been, it seems like, most consistently, most vocal about as this session has drawn on. He didn't get any cut in the initial budget proposals, now a 3% cut. But he says we're not done yet. It looks like we're going to see a whole lot more wrangling over this budget before the end of the month here.
To be sure, I think that's the big story of this legislative session. When the budget came out of the House, there was no tax cut. The House leadership was cool to the idea of an extensive tax cut of the sort that the governor was proposing. Apparently, what seemed to have happened would be two things, I think. One, before the Senate took up the budget, you had Americans for Prosperity run that ad campaign statewide and generate some grassroots lobbying on behalf of the tax cut. And two, it seemed that the governor embarked on what might be called a charm offensive and tried to curry favor with the legislators. And I think the result is that the Senate seems a little more willing to give a tax cut, although not willing to go as far as the governor wants them to.
The governor says that it's nice that they're coming closer together on this issue. Do you see them coming closer together? There's been so much resistance in the legislature to giving that full 10%.
Mm-hmm. It doesn't seem so. To me, I think what the Senate's trying to do is to try to give the governor the overall number of about $500 million in tax cuts and willing to negotiate on the relative allocation of that money, but not to go as far as to give the whole amount to an income tax cut.
And in fact, Senate President Pro Tem David Long said the total package involved here included not only the personal income tax cut of 3%, but also a cut to the inheritance tax and a continued reduction of the corporate income tax rate, which he says, Dan Stockman combined, is just about $500 million, roughly what the governor is looking for. Will that be enough for the executive branch? Because there are additional elements to that package.
Yeah, I mean, luckily, he just got into office, so he's got 4 years to come up with a new slogan. But, you know, I mean, especially in an election year, that kind of thing becomes much more important than it is now. Because if you want to say, I cut income taxes 10%, then that bottom line dollar figure is not really going to matter. What's going to matter is whether you can say that or not. Say you did it. He's got 3 years to get past it, if and come up with something else. So I would think they're probably a little more willing to give on that and say, he can always say, well, we'll come back and get the rest later or whatever. And, like we said, assuming the economy continues to improve, the revenue picture is going to get better and better, and that makes everything easier. I mean, believe me, money doesn't just grease the wheels of politics. It greases the wheels of the budget, of the entire governmental machine. Government's been rough these last few years because there's just not money. And when the money starts pouring in, everything gets easier. And it's a lot easier to negotiate anything and agree to something when you've got something else on the side.
So. Well, speaking of greased wheels, it's a perfect segue into our infrastructure discussion. along with a bit of a tax cut, increased funding for schools, the legislature in this latest proposed budget has allocated more than $200 million for, and Dan, we'll stay with you, a major moves trust fund. But looking at the major projects included in this so far, we see an expansion of I-65. We see an expansion of I-70 near Indianapolis and the completion of I-69. None of this is really Northeast Indiana centric, at least in terms of major projects.
Well, and even if they were, those are state projects, not local projects. And local officials would be more than happy to point out that the city of Fort Wayne alone has an estimated $60 to $65 million gap in what they need to do in roads and streets and what they have money to do. That is a major, major hole, and they have no way to fill it because what has happened is those projects are paid for by the gas tax. As the economy goes down, people buy less gas. As gas prices go up, people buy less gas. And on top of it, our cars are getting more and more fuel efficient and will continue to do so thanks to federal regulations. So there's really no sign without a change that there's ever going to be an increase in gas taxes. It will probably keep going down. That $60, $65 million figure is going to get bigger. That's just the city of Fort Wayne. Now, add in New Haven, the county, Steuben County, DeKalb County, and multiply it across the state, and you're looking at truly astounding numbers. The $200 million, that's, even if that were all applied to local projects, that's not going to go anywhere near. And it's not being applied to local projects. It's being applied to state projects.
Bob Kaler, we have talked on this program before about, when the legislative session comes around, there often seems like this Indianapolis mindset. We can fund projects that are around the city of Indianapolis or that radiate out maybe a little bit. Is this just an example of Fort Wayne needing to get in the back of the line because we did get some major moves, funding up in this area, or is this region kind of being ignored like a lot of people think it often is?
Well, it's worth pointing out that Indianapolis isn't feeling special these days because the state's quashed the Indy and the Central County's attempt to develop a mass transit project. And I think that's probably a big part of it. We just need to have a legislative delegation that's able to look more at the day-to-day business of keeping civilization going the way we want it, as we expect it to. And, and there are some fringe issues that are big distractions from that at this point. Mm-hmm. I think it's interfering.
And Leonard Williams, we have to go to a break in just a minute here. But as Dan points out, there are some increasingly probably increasingly less money coming in to fund roads projects around the state. I mean, are there any immediate actions that the legislature can take to increase that amount of funding, or are they interested in increasing that money in the first place?
It doesn't seem like they're interested in increasing that money, which is part of the problem. One of the things that is evident, again, with this push for cutting taxes, we are not willing to make the kind of spending that we need to invest in the future to make up for the lost time, to provide for future needs that we'll face, not only with roads and bridges, but with water and sewage and all of the other infrastructure projects.
We need to take a quick break here. In the meantime, we hope you get in touch with us this hour. We're talking, of course, about how the 2013 legislative session is going in Indiana. Give us a call. Share your thoughts or your questions. 260-452-1185. Toll free at 800-471-9264. Email middaymatters@nipr.fm. Post on our Facebook wall or send us a tweet. It's @middaymatters. Stay with us. Back in 2 minutes.
On the next Fresh Air, Washington Post economics writer Neil Irwin talks about the extraordinary power of central bankers.
If you have a central banker and you have a printing press and you have the authority of the state imbued in both, you can create money from thin air.
Irwin's new book is The Alchemist, Three Central Bankers and a World on Fire. Join us this afternoon at 1 here on WBOI.
After more than 5 years in prison and five more on probation, former high school football star Brian Banks was exonerated last year, his rape conviction thrown out. Last Wednesday, he signed a contract with the Atlanta Falcons years after he gave up his dream to play professional football. I'm Neil Conan, getting your life back after exoneration. Next Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This afternoon at 2 p.m. here on WBOI.
Support for this program on WBOI is provided by Indiana Center for Middle East Peace, presenting Jewish author Mark Braverman, speaking on Israel and Jewish-Christian relations, Thursday, April 11th, 7 p.m., Grace Episcopal Church. Details, 416-2516.
Support for this program on WBOI is provided by Indiana Tech Law School, opening in Fort Wayne, August 2013. Information on admissions and curriculum online at indianatech.edu/law or 855-TECH-LAW.
This is WBOY Fort Wayne and Midday Matters. I'm Sean Beter. This hour, we're doing one of our regular legislative check-ins. With us, of course, this hour, Bob Kaler from the Fort Wayne News Sentinel, Dan Stockman from the Journal Gazette, and Leonard Williams, professor of political science at Manchester University. We want to hear from you this hour. 260-452-1185. Toll free at 800-471-9264. Email middaymatters@nipr.fm, post on our Facebook wall, or send us a tweet. It's at Midday Matters. And a little bit later in the program here, we'll set our focus on education-specific issues and legislation. Ellie Moxley from our State Impact team covering education will be with us by phone. Dan Stockman, we were talking a little more about some of these issues we had to leave before we went to break.
Well, you know, I mean, it's the basic conflict of there's stuff citizens want, like roads. We would love highways. We want to be able to get to Evansville from here, which you can't. At the same time, you have to pay for that some way. And, you know, politicians are loath to raise taxes. They just don't, especially our General Assembly, just does not want to do it. So, you know, I mean, the obvious answer to the roads problem is you just raise the gas tax. It hasn't been raised in decades. It's really more of a user fee. But again, nobody wants to be that guy that raised the price of gas even further and have tax hike saddled around their neck. But people smarter than me have pointed out that an easy answer is the sales tax on gasoline could just be dedicated to roads the way the gas tax is. We collect a sales tax on top of the other taxes. And right now that sales tax goes into the general fund just like all sales taxes do. But you could make up that revenue that way without actually raising taxes. Of course, then, you know, you've taken revenue from this other pot, which is going to, you know, you're either going to have to replace it or you're going to have to make a cut somewhere, which, again, politicians are loath to do. But
Bob Kaler.
So don't you think that particularly a conservative politician could make some hay by saying, okay, here's a new approach. Let's push down authority and responsibility for more of government's functions to county and municipal and city governments. Why doesn't that happen when a lot of people at the local level call for it year after year, problem after problem?
I think you're trying to apply logic here. And that's always going to run you into trouble with the
Leonard Williams.
It's your chance to be less cynical.
Let's put that question to you.
I don't know if I could be less cynical at this point. It certainly is the case that no one gives up power willingly. There would have to be a major revolt from cities and towns asking for home rule provisions in the Indiana Constitution, perhaps, or legislative authority given to them by the state government.
Or the NRA would have to lobby for it.
Yeah, I suppose.
Then it'd probably go right through.
But certainly, I think even if local governments had that kind of authority, they're already hamstrung by the property tax cuts that were enshrined in the state constitution a couple of years ago. And that makes it very, very difficult for any governmental unit to have more responsibility with less money. They usually want more responsibility and more money simultaneously.
We want to hear your questions and comments today. We're talking, of course, about the 2013 legislative session, how it's progressing so far. If you have a question or comment, get in touch, 260-452-1185, or toll free at 800-471-9264. Email middaymatters@nipr.fm, post on our Facebook wall, or send us a tweet. It's at Midday Matters. Let's open the phones here and go to Daniel. Daniel, good afternoon. You're on the program.
Yes, good afternoon. And one of your guests alluded to what I'm going to ask here. So, businesses must perform, and profit is a key measure of performance. Balance sheets and the other financial documents also give means of evaluating business performance. We've seen companies becoming hyper-efficient or quote-unquote lean. So here's the couple questions. Are there means of making government lean or hyper-efficient so that they can do the same or and or more with equal or less tax money? Or is government functioning best when it promotes high business growth, creating a scenario where higher revenues occur at lower tax rates because business revenues are higher and giving a larger pool out of which to apply a lower tax rate and that go to government? So, yeah, that's the basic question that I have. Does it make sense?
Daniel, Dan's raising his hand over here.
I'll take just the first half and leave the second half to the folks who want to argue trickle down versus other theories. You know, the surest, and Dr. Crawford on the Fort Wayne City Council is famous for saying this, or something close to it. You know, the best way to make government more efficient is to cut revenue. Because, you know, I mean, we've talked about it before, and we'll say it again. Citizens want stuff. We want it all, and we don't want to pay for anything. But these incredible revenue shortfalls in the last 5-6 years have really forced governments at every level to either perform or go bankrupt. I mean, there's kind of no in between. You either have to get better at what you're doing or stop doing some things. In
sure.
some cases, services have been cut. You know, the city of is happy to point out that aside from public safety, they have fewer employees than they did years and years ago. You know, I mean, this kind of thing. I've covered government for 18 years, and it's really, really easy to find waste and fraud and abuse and bad examples of bad government spending. But for the most part, especially in recent years, they have become very, very lean because they have absolutely had to. There's been no other alternative for most.
Yeah, I guess I could say in here too, kind of what scares me big time is some of the deferred maintenance on infrastructure. I was hearing from some civil engineers saying our infrastructure gets what, like a D-?
I think we got upgraded to a D, something like that. We got a third of a letter grade up.
Now, they do have a bit of a stake in this because every road project requires an engineer.
Okay.
So it's part of the full employment for engineers bill. But
Leonard Williams, I know you wanted to get in on this as well.
Yeah, I would agree. I think the need for investment is one of the things we tend to overlook in our drive to cut government spending and taxes for ourselves. One of the things that I think we need to recognize is that this continuing push to cut taxes in order to streamline government, perhaps, is largely a short-term strategy. We might gain some immediate benefit in terms of relative economic growth compared to our neighbors, but over the long haul, it's a race to the bottom, and we really need to have a much more sound intellectual strategy for government spending and taxing.
Daniel, we appreciate your call and your comment. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you. Bye-bye.
All right, bye-bye. 260-452-1185 or toll-free at 800-471-9264. And to your point, Leonard Williams, I mean, I think a lot of folks at the State House would maybe say that, you know, that money that whether it's a tax cut, you know, a personal income tax cut or otherwise, you know, a lot of folks would say that that money is simply better in the hands of the individual, and those folks do control the state house now. That's what the populace elected.
To be sure, but it's a question of how would you maximize the leverage of that spending. And if we look at the tax cut that we're going to get, it's probably going to be a bottle or two of wine, perhaps, and you know that's not going to have a great impact upon the Indiana economy. Or if we go online and spend it somewhere else, it will definitely help people in China, not so much folks here in Indiana.
I suppose that depends on what shelf of wine you shop, but that's another show.
Sure.
Dan Stockman.
Well, I mean, this seems to be a conversation that we kind of dance around a lot and never really get to the heart of because there's too many politics and egos involved. But, you know, that really is kind of the question that's facing us today is, you know, take a look, for example, at something like the interstate system in Indiana. We have spent over the decades hundreds of billions of dollars on these roads. And, you know, you could argue, well, that's all that money could be better spent by individuals on their families and their loved ones and things like that. But where would our economy be without the interstate system? Where, you know, I mean, that because the idea is that, you know, this $1 billion we spent on this road project is going to pay off in the long term with much more than $1 billion in effects.
With less time on the road for paid employees, with less wear and tear on trucks and automobiles, with smoother business
operations.
Yeah, I mean,
look at the difference on Coliseum Boulevard once 469 was built. You know, I mean, that's tough to campaign on. It's not nearly as easy as saying the government's taking money out of your pocket, Bob. You know, I mean, that gets right to the heart of the matter, but it also removes us from the conversation that we need to have. What is the good balance? You know, do we spend too much here? Maybe we do, maybe we don't. And we kind of get away from that.
I want to pivot briefly here. Of course, there's a lot of other legislation pending across the chambers, and we have to go to a break in just a few minutes. Leonard Williams, we heard some recent movements on sentencing guidelines, a new sentencing guidelines bill that's a little bit easier or wants to be a little bit easier on first-time offenders and low-level offenders, but a little bit tougher as you go mm-hmm. up. Tell us how that bill's progressing so far. I know Governor Pence, you know, said he believed in second chances, but doesn't want to appear to be soft on drugs or soft on crime.
Right. It seems to me that what's happening there is very similar to what's happening on taxes, where the governor is trying to step into the legislative process and, you know, stake a claim to particular policy positions. One of the things that is evident is that the legislature, after many years of talking about it, has really made some important moves at reforming those sentencing guidelines and in a very good way, and trying to get nonviolent offenders out of the prison system, which is a vastly expensive enterprise anyway. It's unfortunate, I think, for the governor to come back and take a more ideological position, which is to, you know, punish those offenders much more severely, especially when we're dealing with things like possession of marijuana.
We do need to take a quick break here for the news. We'll continue our check-in on the 2013 Indiana legislative session when we return. And we'll be joined just a little bit later on by Ellie Moxley, our State Impact Indiana reporter covering education. We'll be talking about some of the education legislation that's in the works. We want you to get in touch with us this hour, 260-452-1185, or toll-free at 800-471-9264. Email middaymatters@nipr.fm, post on our Facebook wall, or send us a tweet. Stay with us. It's Midday Matters.
On the next Fresh Air, Washington Post economics writer Neil Irwin talks about the extraordinary power of central bankers.
If you have a central banker and you have a printing press and you have the authority of the state imbued in both, you can create money from thin air.
Irwin's new book is The Alchemist, Three Central Bankers and a World on Fire. Join us this afternoon at 1 here on WBOI.
Good afternoon. You're listening to Northeast Indiana Public Radio. I'm Sarah DeLeo with WBOI News. Former Burmese residents resettled in the Fort Wayne area are protesting violence in their Southeast Asian homeland. About 100 resettled refugees demonstrated Sunday at the Allen County Courthouse in Fort Wayne. Ex-refugees say the protest was called to spread awareness about the Myanmar government and extremist Buddhists who were targeting Muslims in their homeland. Dozens of people were killed last month when violence between Buddhists and minority Muslims shook Myanmar. A pre-dawn fire Tuesday at a religious dormitory linked to a mosque killed 13 children. Authorities blame the fire on an electrical short circuit, but some Muslims say the fire was set intentionally. Fort Wayne has one of the largest U.S. populations of resettled Myanmar refugees. Fort Wayne police have arrested an 18-year-old man in connection with a shooting that killed a 17-year-old youth. De'Adrian Boykins was arrested late Friday and faces a preliminary charge of aggravated battery in connection with the Wednesday slaying of Elijah O. Freeman. Boykins was being held without bond Sunday in the Allen County lockup. Records did not indicate whether he had an attorney. Police have said two men chased Freeman down an alley and fired 6 or 7 gunshots at him before the victim collapsed in a yard. Police Chief Rusty York has said the shooting was gang-related. The death was Allen County's 15th homicide of the year. Legislation aimed at helping recently returned military veterans adjust to college is awaiting the governor's signature. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith reports.
The Combat to College Bill requires Indiana public colleges and universities that enroll at least 200 former military service members to develop a centralized location for admissions, registration, and financial aid for recent military veterans. LaGrange Republican Senator Sue Glick, the bill's author, says the measure essentially creates a one-stop shop that will help veterans transition from the battlefield to a college campus. She says the legislation also requires each school to develop programs that assist with issues such as post-traumatic stress disorder in returning vets.
We want to make sure that those that are coming in with a little additional hardships like this disabilities can address those issues, that the universities are mindful of those needs of those student veterans.
Glick's bill is one of several measures dealing with veteran education and jobs, including legislation from Indianapolis Democratic Representative Dan Forrestall. His bill allows combat paramedics and emergency medical technicians to skip costly and unnecessary retraining once they return from service. Forrestall says the measure authorizes the state's Emergency Medical Services Commission, which licenses paramedics and EMTs, to immediately license a veteran if they pass a practical exam.
Having that kind of streamlined, I think, will take some of the roadblocks out of the way for our veterans so they can get back to work doing what they love, serving in the communities.
Forrestall's bill has been signed by the governor while Glick awaits his signature. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith.
And Indiana legislators are set to again take up a proposal that would require all public and charter schools have an employee armed with a loaded gun during school hours. The House Ways and Means Committee is scheduled on Monday to consider the financial impact of the bill that was endorsed last week by another House panel. Indiana would become the first state in the country to require armed school employees if the bill becomes law. Supporters of the requirement say it would lessen the vulnerability of schools to violent attacks, such as the December elementary school shooting in Connecticut. Republican Governor Mike Pence and other state officials have said they do not believe that the state should mandate that local schools have armed employees. You're listening to 89.1 FM, WBOY Fort Wayne. Now back to Midday Matters.
Minutes till the top of the hour, 1 o'clock. It's Midday Matters on WBOI Fort Wayne. I'm Sean Beter, along with Bob Kaler from the Fort Wayne News Sentinel. With us as well, Leonard Williams, professor of political science at Manchester University. And earlier in the program, we had Dan Stockman from the Fort Wayne Journal Gazette. Thanks very much to Dan for being with us this afternoon. Joining us, filling the seat, as it were, at this moment, we have Ellie Moxley, one of our State Impact Indiana reporters covering education. Ellie, can you hear us okay?
I can, Sean. How are you?
Very well, Ellie. Thanks very much for taking time out. I know you and Kyle Stokes have been terribly busy the last few weeks here, so I appreciate your time.
No problem.
We wanted to invite you on to talk a little more specifically about some of the education legislation moving through the State House at this time. Of course, a lot of bills we saw kind of flare up at the beginning and then die out only to be reborn. We'll get to some of those. But I want to get to an issue we talked about on an earlier Midday Matters a few weeks ago with you. Of course, the State Supreme Court basically said, you know, vouchers are okay. It was a 5-0 decision. Tell us about what you've seen in terms of movement in the State House on expanding the voucher program so far.
You know, even before the Indiana Supreme Court gave the green light for the state's voucher program, so to speak, state lawmakers were already kind of considering some expansions to that program. Well, since we've talked, it's been kind of interesting. One of the big parts of that bill was to extend eligibility for incoming kindergartners to make them automatically qualify for a voucher. Right now, the requirement is that students have to spend a year in public school first. But, you know, Senator Luke Kinley had some real reservations. He was worried that, you know, the fiscal impact of that would just be too much. And before that bill, you know, left the Senate Education Committee, he had it amended so that getting rid of that incoming kindergarten eligibility piece and making it so that students who are attending F schools that got a letter grade of F from the Department of Education would then qualify for a voucher. And that actually makes Indiana's program more similar to some of the other large-scale voucher initiatives in other states. In neighboring Ohio, that's kind of the law there. It's less about, you know, what requirements you meet, but you just need to be in a failing school to qualify for a voucher in Ohio. So that's expanding the voucher program, but maybe not as broadly as it would have been even before the Supreme Court decision.
Even so, as we talked about earlier, well, I guess it was last month now, Indiana still has, you know, one of the most expansive programs anywhere in the country.
It does. You know, right now, the last 2 years, there's been a cap on the number of students that could receive vouchers. Indiana hasn't hit those caps. It was 15,000 this last year. About a little over 9,000 students applied for vouchers. But next year, the cap comes off. But it's really hard to say what will happen next. We have a lot of people who really look at school choice issues and who kind of study participation of, you know, private schools in these sort of programs, and they say that Indiana probably won't have a huge jump in voucher use unless if some things about the program are changed in terms of how much students can qualify for or, you know, incentives for private schools to come into the state, because the bottom line is most private schools were operating before the voucher program at or near capacity, because that's what it takes to, you know, have the financial backing to keep a school open. And so, you know, schools can take a handful of kids here and there, but the number of schools we see that are actually, you know, truly growing their enrollment by significant amounts because of the voucher program is still small.
We want to hear from our listeners today. If you have a question or comment about during this part of the program, education legislation moving through the State House at this moment, give us a call. Share your thoughts, 260-452-1185, or toll free at 800-471-9264. You can always email us, of course, middaymatters@nipr.fm, post on our Facebook wall, or send us a tweet. It's at Midday Matters. Ellie, before we move on to some other bills, I have to ask you, how much of you know, what's happening in the State House now in terms of vouchers and other legislation, it remains the legacy of Tony Bennett? Obviously, he was a big proponent of vouchers and charter schools, but we do have a new superintendent of public instruction.
I think right after Bennett's defeat, which was, I think, unexpected by a lot of people, because Bennett had, you know, he's a powerful guy. He's a guy that had a lot of attention in a lot of circles for, you know, pushing his education agenda. And he had a lot of money in the bank. And still, Glenda Ritz, a teacher and union activist from Washington Township, was able to, unseat him and become our next superintendent of public instruction. And right after the election, I think the tone was very much, you know, we've enacted these education measures, and we are going to stand by them whether or not Bennett's in office. I think that's been toned down a little bit as the session goes on. There's been a lot of bills where I think Ritz's voice or her take on it has been allowed to shine through. I think that was especially evident in some of the discussions that were had earlier this session in the State House about Common Core, the nationally crafted academic standards that Bennett was a big proponent of. But I think that there's been some room for Ritz to work in some of these areas and, you know, get her voice out there and kind of what her take is. I think she's also, she's had to, change, instead of angling for broad changes, I think she has definitely moved towards a position where she is trying to work within, currently proposed legislation to get her mark on it, even if it's not the ambitious agenda she laid out during the campaign.
Bob Kaler.
So, Ellie, do you think that that measure of success that Glenda Ritz has had with the legislature, do you think it's more due to her proving to be savvy at politics or Republicans feeling more cautious than maybe they were in the days after the election?
I think it's probably a combination. Even before the election, there were some Republican lawmakers who were saying, it's time to slow down. At the time, Bennett was talking about enacting a district takeover provision instead of just a school takeover provision. And, I think that had some Republicans even worried that maybe Indiana was moving too far too fast. So I think there was definitely some room for some sympathetic ears, some people who were at least interested in what Glenda Ritz had to say. And I think she, now that she's on the scene and she is in the Department of Education, I think she's kind of learning, what works and what doesn't and how to, work within what the lawmakers are doing. I think she's had her most success in places where she has been able to, if something's going on that she does support, being able to grab onto that and show that she can work with lawmakers in another party.
We do need to take just a quick break here, and then we'll continue our discussion with Bob Kaler, Leonard Williams, and Ellie Moxley from our State Impact Indiana team. In the meantime, we hope you get in touch with us with your questions and comments, 260-452-1185. Toll free at 800-471-9264. Email middaymatters@nipr.fm, post on our Facebook wall, or send us a tweet. It's @middaymatters. Stay with us, back in 2 minutes.
On the next Fresh Air, Washington Post economics writer Neil Irwin talks about the extraordinary power of central bankers.
If you have a central banker and you have a printing press and you have the authority of the state imbued in both, you can create money from thin air.
Irwin's new book is The Alchemist, 3 Central Bankers and a World on Fire. Join us this afternoon at 1 here on WBOI.
Prosperity in Mount Hope, West Virginia, faded along with the coal industry. Now the Boy Scouts are building an adventure camp nearby with millions of dollars and many employees.
I would like for some of those people to consider homes in Mount Hope to live and raise families.
Will the small town reap the big change it needs? That's later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
That's weekdays starting at 4 on WBOI Northeast Indiana Public Radio.
Hey, this is Peter Sagal, and I was wondering, if you're not doing anything on May 2nd, would you like to go to the movies and see our show? Because we'll be simulcasting Wait Wait Live from New York City to theaters all over the country, and I thought it'd be, fun if you could come. Maybe we'll get a soda after, if that's okay. That's Wait Wait Live in theaters on May 2nd.
You can join NIPR at Regal Coldwater Crossing. For advance tickets, go to nipr.fm.
It's Midday Matters on WBOI Fort Wayne. I'm Sean Beter, along with Bob Kaler from the Fort Wayne News Sentinel, Leonard Williams, professor of political science at Manchester University, and with us by phone, it's Ellie Moxley, a reporter with our State Impact Indiana team covering education. That's, of course, a partnership between Indiana Public Broadcasting and National Public Radio. During this about 9 minutes of the program, we'll be talking about education legislation moving through the Indiana General Assembly. And we want you to get in touch with us, 260-452-1185. You can always email us, middaymatters@nipr.fm, post on our Facebook wall, or send us a tweet at Midday Matters. I have an email question here from Suzanne. Sue says, at what point does the state legislation for vouchers and support of charters and homeschooling conflict with the state constitutional requirements for public education as it continues to drain funding from the public schools? And Ellie Moxley, let's put this to you. Of course, you know, as charters and vouchers have evolved, even in just the last few years in Indiana, it's been a terribly tangled process.
You know, I think that that's a question that anyone who is an advocate for public schools is asking at this point. You know, the Indiana State Teachers Association challenged the state's voucher law in court, and the Indiana Supreme Court said that, you know, at least on the grounds of the fact that a lot of the money of the in the voucher program is going towards religious private schools, that's not a conflict of interest for the state. The state is not directly funding those private religious schools because the money is going to the parents who then choose where their kids go to school. I think it's one of those things that I know that public schools are feeling this right now, and it's definitely a concern that a lot of, I think, public school advocates have at this moment. You know, for every student that leaves their school, that leaves them somewhat in the hole. I think that people, if you don't follow school funding closely or you don't pay a lot of attention to that, I'm sure it's easy for people to say, you know, well, it's just a handful of kids. We're not talking about a huge program. And at the end of the day, 9,000 students taking voucher money and going to private schools is a very small piece of the Indiana education landscape. But I think part of the issue is, you know, a school district may have 30 kids, you know, leave for, you know, private school, but it's not like all of those kids came out of the third grade and you can eliminate one third grade teacher and that solves your problem. It's those kids come out of different buildings and different classrooms, and that leaves, you know, that money that the public schools have to try to make up the difference. And that's something that all public schools are struggling with right now.
Bob Kaler.
I've been paying some attention to the school safety bill, which began as a pretty uncontroversial bill that was going to pump up the funding for school resource officers and then morphed into an armed educator support bill. And it's become fairly controversial, even among Republicans, it seems, with that move. How did that happen, and what do you think the prospects are for it in its current form?
You know, in the wake of, obviously, the terrible shootings in Connecticut late last year, I think everyone at the start of this session wanted to talk about school safety and how we could beef up security in our public schools. The original bill, it was a partnership between Senator Pete Miller, a Republican, and the Attorney General. And what they wanted to do was, for schools that didn't already have resource officers, and that's, you know, trained police officers that spend time in the buildings, you know, cultivating those relationships, providing some additional level of security, they wanted to provide some state money, matching funds, for districts that wanted to go ahead and say, you know what, it would be really good for our school community if, you know, we could hire a trained police officer to be in our buildings and to kind of provide that extra level of support. What happened last week was Jim Lucas added an amendment to the bill that would require armed personnel in every school. And that's been kind of, you know, a lot of Republicans have put on the brakes and said, hey, wait a minute, you know, Governor Pence doesn't support this. He says that, you know, this should be a local decision. And that's, I think, the concern with this. The Superintendent Ritz is also on the same page. I don't think this bill will pass in its current form. Senate President David Long, he's already saying that if it gets back to the Senate with this amendment, this House amendment still on the bill, then he's going to remove it. So I think what we will probably see is we will probably see the bill pass with, you know, school security officers intact. What I think this amendment really does is it starts a conversation about, if we do want to have guns in schools, if we are comfortable with doing that, who should carry them, and what kind of training should they receive? I think a lot of people feel very secure having, you know, a trained police officer in a school building, but it becomes a different equation when it's maybe just a teacher who is carrying a gun.
And correct me if I'm wrong here, Ellie, but I believe this this amendment coming up is at least somewhat in line with the recent presentation from the NRA advocating it's similar to a policy that that they're advocating on a national level.
It is. It's not too far off. I think the questions that remain, I think a lot of schools have said at this point, different districts have voiced their opposition saying that they are against this proposal. I think it's one of those things that right now, technically under Indiana law, if a school district wanted to have a teacher designated to carry a gun in every building, they could do that because Indiana teachers can carry guns into schools. So the real question is whether or not this should be a mandate. Should it be something that every school should do, or is it something that at a local level the school district should decide if it's the right choice for their district or not?
And Leonard Williams, and politically speaking, of course, you know, Republicans do have supermajorities in both houses, but as Ellie's pointing out, still a lot of, political caution even going into this issue.
Right. It shows you that party identification alone doesn't determine public policy, that there are splits within the parties in the legislature on a variety of issues. I'm curious to know just which groups are lobbying for this kind of legislation. Maybe, Ellie, if you could talk to us about that.
I think it's hard to say where exactly the support is coming from. I think for some of the, I think for the bill's sponsor even, Pete Miller, I think it kind of threw him for a loop when this amendment got added to the bill. It's one of those things. Obviously, Indiana, I think there is a lot of support for gun ownership here, and there is a lot of support for, additional protection for our public schools. But, it kind of ends up on a continuum of, you might support having guns and the right to carry a gun, but then you start wondering whether or not you want your kid's second grade teacher doing it.
We only have about 2 minutes left in the program here, but briefly, Ellie, we heard from you and from Kyle not so long ago here that REPA 2 has come back into the statewide discussion. Tell us just a little bit briefly about what REPA 2 is and where it stands now.
REPA 2 is kind of the education speak shorthand for a set of teacher licensing requirements that would allow people who didn't get an education degree but got good grades in college and wanted to teach in Indiana to take a test and get an adjunct license so that they could be in schools without maybe having this education background. It's kind of a classic debate in education circles over whether pedagogy is important, how you teach and how you manage a classroom, or whether content area knowledge is important. It looked like it was a done deal back in December. The state board voted for it kind of over the objections of superintendent-elect Ritz. It was kind of one of Tony Bennett's final acts as state superintendent. But interestingly enough, there was kind of a change pushed through at the last second, added to the REPA 2 language that would specify some more teacher training for these people who were adjunct license holders. And as a result of that, it didn't pass muster with the Attorney General's office. And in the interim, the rulemaking period expired, which means even though the majority of the state board is in favor of these licensure changes, they're going to have to completely reopen this process again, and that's expected to take about a year. So it looked like it was a done deal, but it's going to be revisited. It means that, the people that turned out at public hearings to oppose some of these changes will have a second chance to do so, and it'll be interesting to see what happens moving forward because these are changes that Superintendent Ritz does not support.
All right. Well, we unfortunately have a lot more to talk about, but we have to leave it there. Ellie Moxley from our State Impact Indiana team, thanks so much for being with us on Midday Matters today.
Thank you.
Thanks also to Leonard Williams, professor of political science at Manchester University, and Bob Kaler from the Fort Wayne News Sentinel. Gentlemen, thank you as well.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
And thanks to Dan Stockman from the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette for being with us this hour. I'm Sean Beter, and this is Northeast Indiana Public Radio broadcasting from the Madge Rothschild Studios. It's WBOI Fort Wayne, WBKE North Manchester. It's 1 o'clock. Have a great day.